The passage recently of the Inflation Reduction Act in the United States unleashed the largest investment ever toward addressing climate change. But it also left many countries questioning some of its policies and how they bend, if not break, international trade rules under the WTO.
I don't think this is purely protectionist by any means, and I don't think it's aimed at specific countries, probably with the exception of China. I think it's more a matter of the Biden administration understanding that building out a domestic clean manufacturing and sort of clean energy economy more broadly is sort of necessary for a successful energy transition.
In today's program, green industrial policy, how to move forward on climate change without going backward on trade.
I'm Noah Kaufman. I am an economist and a senior research scholar at the Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy. I've had a variety of different positions in the climate policy space over the years in the public and private sector. Most recently, I spent the first couple of years of the Biden administration as a senior economist at the Council of Economic Advisors.
So you don't see these huge investments like putting international trade on the slippery slope in terms of, you know, free and fair trade going forward?
Well, that might be an unintended consequence, and that's part of the reason why I think the international trade rules have to be redesigned to some extent to accommodate these types of policies. And I think the United States and other countries have to be cautious about how they put these policies into place.
Noah Kaufman's article on green trade tensions is published in the June edition of Finance and Development magazine.
All right, so we on this podcast talked about industrial policy just a couple of weeks ago, but it was more about, you know, how governments essentially choose national champions to, you know, companies or firms that are in line with their strategic or political objectives. What is the difference between when we're talking about green industrial policy? How does that work?
I'm not sure it's a difference as much as just a subset of what you just described. I think it's the application of that philosophy of the government sort of investing in strategic homegrown industries, but just applying it to, you know, clean energy, other carbon-free products, and their associated supply chains.
Mm. Yeah, and so the situation that we're in or have been in for the past, say, 5 or maybe 10 years, about so much focus on commitments under the Paris Agreement, you know, in terms of industrial policy, do you think there's a lot more focus on climate-related industry?
There's no question. I mean, if we're serious about our climate commitments outlined in the Paris Agreement, we're talking about a real revamping of our economies over the next few decades. You know, we're talking about upending the energy system from mostly dirty sources to mostly clean sources. And, you know, energy touches almost everything we do and we work on. So this is already a huge source of investment in the public and private sectors. And if we're serious about our climate goals, I think it will only increase going forward. You know, we're talking at the global level, it could be trillions of dollars in investment a year. I mean, the industrial policy framework tends to focus more on the public sector doing that investing, and that doesn't necessarily need to be the case. You know, we could have, you know, market mechanisms that spur private sector investments. You could have government programs where you try to crowd in private sector investments. And realistically, you probably have some combination of the two. But regardless, I mean, I think there's, for good reason, there's been a big emphasis on clean investment that's only growing.
Hmm. And in this article that you've written for Finance and Development magazine, you use IRA, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act, that recently passed in the United States as an example of how things can change in terms of trade. Is the pressure on these governments now to meet climate commitments under the Paris Agreement being used as an excuse to revert back to trade practices that were essentially outlawed by the WTO years ago? I mean, do you see protectionism creeping in because of these large climate action plans that we're seeing now?
it's a lot of different factors. I mean, you know, if you just think of the U.S. perspective, I think maybe the biggest factor is that we tried for decades to go with the more sort of standard playbook of centering our climate policies on, you know, market mechanisms like carbon pricing or EPA regulations, and just haven't had a whole lot of success. So one way to look at this is kind of a pivot just based on political necessity, right? That if we didn't have this merging of climate and industrial policy and some of sort of the more protectionist elements, the IRA doesn't get across the finish line. And if the IRA doesn't get across the finish line, the United States is probably sort of off in the wilderness on its climate policy for the next decade. And if the United States isn't engaged on climate, it's hard to see a successful global pathway. So I think part of this is really just out of the necessary political economy. There's certainly an element to it of, the need for, I guess the nice way to put it is supply chain resilience, but I think there's sort of an anti-China sentiment out there as well. For better or for worse, I think there's a real desire to diversify away from a dependence on China, particularly in some of these, products like batteries, which are so, so important to a clean energy economy. And, you know, China may have 70 or 80% of the supply chain for batteries right now. There's a real desire to move away from that. And there's just, I guess, one more thing I'll mention is, the United States is the biggest oil and gas producing country in the world, right? So the idea that the politicians in a country like ours are going to sort of voluntarily shift away from an economy, where a lot of the productivity and the jobs are provided by the fossil fuel industries without, actively trying to replace it with sort of successful, homegrown, cleaner energy industries is probably unrealistic.
And you mentioned there the batteries, which are mostly manufactured in China. And back to this IRA, within that deal, there are, benefits for consumers within the United States buying electric vehicles, but only if the batteries are manufactured in the United States. So an interesting kind of trade policy. Do you think that would have been acceptable, like even 5 years ago? And how are other countries reacting to things like that in these trade deals?
Right. I mean, I think a lot of these other countries would say it's not acceptable now either. But I think it goes back to what I said before about this is what was needed to get the policy across the finish line. So the question is, what do we do now, right? Because if you're in the standpoint of a European country, I totally understand the frustration. I mean, Europe has kind of been playing by the more standard climate policy playbook over the last couple decades. They have a big carbon pricing program and sort of combine that with subsidies and regulations. They were able to get that across the finish line while the United States was not. So for the United States to then have these policies that, seem to be effectively drawing investment away from other countries into the United States, I can understand the frustration, and it's caused, to some extent, some negotiations between the countries where I think the United States has shown some openness to interpreting some of the language to be more flexible around things like free trade agreements. It's caused Europe to propose its own policies to counteract those of the United States. But there's something fundamentally unfair about that, especially when it comes to maybe more developing countries that don't have the fiscal space to be spending all this money on the transition, at least from the government perspective.
Hmm. Yeah, so when you're looking, there's going to be more and more of these battles, essentially, for countries and regions to sort of establish themselves in whatever industry they need to, for their economies to sort of move forward. And given that the WTO has lost a little bit of its oomph in recent years in terms of settling trade disputes, if it's not the WTO that can do it, who's going to do it?
Well, so I think there's no question the WTO really needs to evolve to be more relevant in this period of green industrial policy. It wasn't, its rules were not designed for this situation. And one thing we point out in our article is that It's really just not realistic for countries around the world to undertake these large-scale transformations of their energy systems and economies without major investments in particularly emerging clean energy technologies. And you know, even economists would sort of support the idea that there are market failures. That means governments have to invest in sort of early stage deployments, innovation and development and deployment of technologies. And it's just not realistic that they're going to do that for the entire world. You know, countries are going to focus on, the industries and the jobs at home. So just creating some space for that is probably a necessity. And I think just there's even an economic rationale for it. But I don't see the current flexibility in the WTO rules for that. So I don't know exactly how we get from here to there, right? I mean, I think a lot of people would say, well, the United States should have tried to change the rules before jumping ahead and arguably violating them. But that may be what happens, is that the WTO sort of starts to get ignored and out of necessity starts to adjust. Because I just don't think it's also not fair, again, to other parts of the world where if the WTO is, for example, ruling against Indonesia's ability to restrict its nickel exports, how can we expect other countries to comply with those kinds of rulings if we're sort of violating the rules ourselves? Mm.
So behind all this, these huge investments in green technology and pushing for green industrial policy is carbon pricing and the tariffs that come along with carbon pricing, which is essentially what makes any of this economically viable. Where does carbon pricing fit into this story?
Well, so, as a card-carrying economist, I fully believe that carbon pricing should have a very important role in any decarbonization strategy. As I mentioned earlier, that's what Europe is doing. It's what the United Kingdom is doing. It's what Canada is doing. Other countries around the world as well are sort of following the playbook, not like relying solely on a carbon price, but really centering their strategy around the idea that we need to make carbon-intensive goods relatively more expensive, right? So consumers and producers switch to cleaner goods and, in sort of a market-friendly way. So there's a role for it for sure. I think the United States, it's just a political reality that at least at the federal level, we haven't been able to pass any kind of carbon price, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. So there's no question that creates a bit of an awkwardness when it comes to how does the United States cooperate with Europe or with Canada or with the United Kingdom that does have these carbon pricing policies in place. Because, from the European perspective, so they're out with their carbon border adjustment mechanism, their CBAM proposal, that is essentially an extension of their carbon price to imported products, right? That currently the price applies to products produced within Europe, and the CBAM basically says we're going to try to apply roughly the same price to similar imported products. There's talk about carbon tariffs in the United States as well, and sort of a desire to harmonize those efforts with Europe, but it just makes a lot less sense from a U.S. policy perspective because we don't have that domestic carbon price. It really is more of a straight tariff on sort of the carbon intensity of imports. And the rationale here in the United States is to say, well, our manufactured goods, like our steel is relatively clean compared to the rest of the world's steel. So we're kind of use that as a basis for penalizing the dirty goods abroad. And then I think foreign countries look at that and say, well, part of the reason why your manufacturing is cleaner is because you're a developed country that, in the case of steel, you have this stockpile of recycled steel and you can use these electric arc furnaces where, developed countries kind of need to be on the more polluting side of the spectrum.
So if carbon pricing is something that, the United States and Europe don't sort of see eye to eye on, how much of a problem is that in terms of coming to a global solution for a global problem like climate change?
I'd say it's a problem, but I wouldn't take it too far because, you know, the whole framework of the Paris Agreement is that, you know, countries put forth their own targets and figure out, given their own domestic circumstances, how they go about achieving those targets. So I think there's nothing inconsistent with what the United States is trying to do right now, which is to achieve some fairly aggressive emissions targets over the next decade, but without a domestic carbon price. I just think it creates some difficulties and awkwardness when the countries try to come together and collaborate on things like border carbon adjustments or climate clubs. If a country like Europe is charging its domestic industries for their emissions and the United States is subsidizing them, it just puts the firms who are sometimes competing in international industries on very different footing. So there's no question it creates some tension, and that's a problem because climate is a global problem that requires a global solution, and that really does require cooperation in, you know, across borders. And I think that does become more challenging when countries have sort of fundamentally different strategies.
Yeah, so whatever the solution is, it will involve a very large dose of cooperation, as you just said, but that is really not obvious these days. So the G7, for example, is I think trying hard to come up with solutions to some of the issues. Like, what do you think are the most important things that need to happen, like, now for things to be put on the right track in terms of, you know, addressing climate change? And do you think the G7 or any other one of those multilateral organizations or institutions have any sway in making that happen?
Sure they do. And, you know, I think I'll mention a couple of things. Number one, climate clubs of some kind could be a very important framework for a sort of limited cooperation. We're not talking about harmonizing economy-wide carbon prices, but again, taking a sector like steel, for countries to get together and say, we're going to come to an agreement on a set of long-term goals for how to decarbonize the steel industry and, you know, align incentives so that, you know, developing countries aren't getting the short end of the stick. There's investment to help a country like India leapfrog above, like, beyond their more polluting fleet of steel plants to cleaner varieties. There's penalties in place, like tariffs, on countries that aren't cooperating, and really sort of trying to sort of harmonize the goals and make it in all countries' best interests to move towards cleaner industries. And it probably does make sense to go on a sector-by-sector basis, similar to what we saw with the Kigali Agreement, for example, for HFCs. So that's one thing. I do think the other thing I'll mention is just the whole discussion of international climate finance, starting in Paris. The richer countries have committed a lot of money, you know, $100 billion a year in assistance to developing countries to help them with their decarbonization and adaptation efforts. And those promises haven't been kept at all. So it just makes any other kind of cooperation with the developing world much, much more difficult until the rich countries start following through on those commitments, let alone sort of the more recent discussions about sort of a separate loss and damage fund for sort of historical climate responsibility. So I think it's difficult, again, because the politics, if you just think about it from the United States perspective, again, you can't get a large amount of international climate finance funding through our Congress here. I mean, an alternative, I think what the Biden administration is arguing is that we're going to help the world by improving, you know, our own sort of technology and innovation efforts to improve clean technologies that the rest of the world can use. But I'm not sure how well that argument is being taken elsewhere.
Mm. But this IRA, again, is probably the biggest investment toward climate change ever, anywhere, like $378 billion, I think. But in your article, you suggest that, you know, just because of the nature of that agreement, that it will likely draw a lot of investment away from Europe and away from other climate-critical regions in the world to the United States. How do you see that happening, and what would be the impact of that if it does?
I mean, it's already happening to some extent. You hear anecdotes, in weekly, if not daily now, of companies that are sort of talking about how investing in the United States is pretty attractive right now, given the subsidy environment. So, like I said before, I don't think this is purely protectionist by any means, and I don't think it's aimed at other countries, probably with the exception of China. I think it's more a matter of the Biden administration understanding that building out a domestic clean manufacturing and sort of clean energy economy more broadly is sort of necessary for a successful energy transition. And I think there's a pretty strong case to be made there.
So you don't see these huge investments as like putting international trade on the slippery slope in terms of, you know, free and fair trade going forward?
Well, that might be an unintended consequence. And that's part of the reason why I think the international trade rules have to be redesigned to some extent to accommodate these types of policies. And I think the United States and other countries have to be cautious about how they put these policies into place, right? Like, I think there's a fine line between purely protectionist policies where we're aiming for homegrown supply chains in every industry. I think that's not desirable. And even, you know, you hear the Biden administration representatives saying that that's not desirable, versus I think on the other end of the spectrum, this idea that we're just going to have totally unfettered free trade isn't realistic either. And it hasn't worked all that well, particularly in this space over the last couple decades.
Noah Kaufman, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Noah Kaufman is an economist and senior research scholar at Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy. You can read his article on green trade tensions in the June issue of Finance and Development magazine. Check it out at imf.org/FND. And look for more IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.